So I do that short intro, then I'm going to just ask you to give us a little bit more background about yourself and your company, okay? And that's, have at it with that. That's promo material for you. Again, under a minute would be great.
Super.
Here we go. Welcome to SaaS Backwards, a podcast that helps SaaS CEOs and CMOs to accelerate growth and enhance profitability. Our guest today is Dr. James Norrie, founder and chief product evangelist at CyberConn IQ, which offers an integrated human risk management platform deploying patented behavioral science methods to improve employee compliance with security best practices. Hey, James, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much, Ken. Delighted to be here today.
Really excited to dig in on this topic, but before we do, could you please tell us just a little bit more about yourself and your company?
Sure. So, quick professional background. I've been at this long before we had the sexy title cyber and cybersecurity added to everything, and it was information privacy and security. And so, when I look back on my career, I realized that this was a human problem probably before most other people did. I've never viewed it purely as a technical problem, but as a behavioral problem. Now we see this rapid evolution in the marketplace. I'm sure we'll talk about this today. The emerging SEC guidelines, the changes to NIST, like finally everybody's beginning to realize that when technology has created the problem, technology in turn can't solve it. So my career has been spent at that intersection of regulation, compliance, and law. I have a law degree, and it's an unfortunate character defect. Obviously, a computer engineering degree in the technical background, and then business and psychology. So for me, it's an excellent time to be doing this work. And really, my personal objective and the mission of CyberConn IQ is to change the trajectory of the global conversation away from fear and towards a sense of confidence by the human that they can be part of the solution, not part of the problem, and that we can all be safer online.
Well, I mean, certainly cybersecurity, online safety, the potential risks of the latest hacking and malware and ransomware attacks, pretty gigantic. Do you want to frame sort of the size of the problem and what kinds of companies are at risk?
Well, first of all, I will dispatch a myth right away, Ken. No company is too small to be attacked nowadays. And that is particularly true because we now have cybersecurity crime at scale. And what's really interesting is just as we are talking about SaaS business models, they have crime as a service business model. So it's really quite remarkable that the bad guys have become very efficient at a business model that makes it very cost effective for them to attack even small enterprise. Two, we haven't seen anything yet. And I don't want to sow fear, but rather awareness. And I think it's very important for people to understand that as we enter the age of generative AI, those tools are already in the hands of the bad guys. We see them already being deployed and used to escalate both the quantity and the quality of the attack. They're becoming harder and harder for people to detect without very sophisticated improvements in their cyber judgment and their own intuition. We are not going to be able to get rid of this problem until we can delve deeper into why people are so vulnerable and engage them as part of the solution. We really need that human firewall to become as good as it needs to be because the defenders are only going to get better and better.
Yeah, I mean, it's really interesting. I remember very early in my entrepreneuring career around software and services, I actually worked on a startup with a couple of friends on spam filtering. And it seemed at the time we could do it all with technology. And I think for a fair amount of time, people thought it was, as you said in the beginning, a technology solution for a technology problem, but it's really not. And I guess I'm wondering, if you could sort of set the stage for how you got into this business and what the premise is of a human defense platform.
Sure. Well, as I wrote in my book, so I'm a serial entrepreneur and a serial author, but I really love what I do, but I'm an academic at my core. So my intellectual curiosity around business problems, particularly those that I'm working with my clients on, seem to drive this breakthrough in a lab that then turns into a patent that then turns into a company. So it's kind of an interesting journey when this happens. And I'm sure that would be a familiar one to many people in this audience. But the genesis of this idea was pretty simple. I was dealing with a very large client, a global bank, and this particular bank had access to all the resources you could possibly imagine, Ken. There was really nothing they couldn't buy, any tool, any platform. They could do pretty much anything they wanted to with the support of the global CEO and CISO to experiment with how to get 900 or so investment bankers to follow some simple rules. Now, you think that that's an easy problem, but think for a second about the human condition, the psychology, our personalities. It's not as easy as we think. And in no other part of the business do we assume just because we tell people what is appropriate and good and important for them to do that they'll simply do it. We work on incentives and motivation and controls. And so cyber kind of lost sight of this because so much of what's happened in the last decade or more when we've had generic, basic cybersecurity training is we simply tell employees, look, do this, don't click this, don't do that, don't do this. It's all simple rules. Just follow the rules. We'll all be fine. Well, it's not that simple. It really isn't a simple problem. So I was sitting there with my bank client, and we had just finished doing a bunch of training on passwords and identity control and everything else. And we begged them not to write down their username and password combinations. Now, this is several years ago, but here's what I'll tell you. When the bank was closed for a holiday, we went through the trading floor. And where do you think we found, I don't know, 43, 44% of the time, Ken, where did you think we found those things written down?
On post-it notes on the monitor.
Well, so not quite that obvious because it would be detected, right? So they'd gotten the message the bank was watching. So they became a little more crafty, might be the right word, to be gentle. So Ken, where else could you guess they might have
found? I'm saying top right drawer on a post-it
note. Aha! Number one spot, top right drawer underneath the little stationery tray. Second one, underneath the keyboard. You lift the keyboard, there's the sticky or there's the recipe card, right? Now, inside the physical premises of the bank, they didn't feel at risk. But the point is not that. The point is, how do you get people to do something that involves a voluntary change in behavior? How do you get them to comply with what we know are real vulnerabilities, whether those are physical security risks, whether those are online security risks? It's about changing the perspective of the employee to want them to do something for themselves and because it's the right thing to do and the right reasons. So as my client is plaintively sitting there saying, is there anything else you can do? And it started to occur to me that this was no longer in the dominion of a platform or a control or a tool, or it had nothing to do with cyber hygiene or endpoint security anymore. It had everything to do with that singular human in the moment. And that began a journey of discovering what else might work. And we were lucky enough to do some really fundamentally good research, hundreds and hundreds of hours worth of work on this tool that became the patented product, which is now generating world-class results. So it's accidental by design. How about that?
I like it. And, you know, it's interesting, you know, habit change is probably right? The number one problem in a number of domains, including, you know, better health outcomes for people. So
well, and, you know, I often turn to my clients and I say, listen, if you want proof that telling people what is good for them to do and that they then don't do it, you just have to ask anybody who's made a New Year's resolution if they've kept it. So it's a classic, you know, easy question, Ken, because we know what's good for us and we know we should be doing it. Doesn't always mean, to your point, that we do it. And we see it in all areas of our life. So habituation and conditioning, that's a big part of what we do, as is sensitization and getting people to realize when they're vulnerable, how urgency or emergency changes their demeanor and their appetite. You know, it's a whole bunch of really good behavioral science. You know, behavioral science is called a science for a reason. So by bringing behavioral science in, so what we like to say is by combining technology and psychology, we get world-class results and an impact that we can prove actuarially, mathematically, statistically, however you want us to do it. We have 13 independent client studies where we can put side-by-side comparisons in place. And every single time we will get a better result. And we'll get a better result because we're personalizing the journey for the individual through a series of really complex assessments and education about things and triggers and all, you know, I don't want to try and explain it all on the podcast. You can find more details at cyberconiq.com. But the bottom line is when you teach people about themselves, and who doesn't want to know more about themselves, Ken? The neat thing is they have a tendency to both enjoy the experience and to apply more of it in the real world. And that's all we want. We want our clients to get a voluntary change in behavior.
Now, again, behavior change is the hardest part of any program like this. So I think it's worth digging in, visiting your website to learn more. One of the things that got our attention as we were preparing for today was you've been very successful in raising investment funds for the company. And even in the current situation where many firms find it very difficult to find investments on a favorable basis, you raised $5 million in June, end of June. And would love to know how you went about that, what made Cybercon IQ, an attractive investor and investment for Stonegate, and what you are telling your peers who might ask you for advice about how to go about fundraising in today's environment.
So as you already did, a shout out to Stonegate IP. I got to tell you, when you find the right capital partner who has confidence, not just in the product, but also the people, you have a fit that is to be treasured. So, we're really very lucky to have come into this particular arrangement. Now, I have to tell you that part of that is a knowing and being known within certain circles. And I always tell entrepreneurs this, that there's a difference between running a business and raising capital, and they're both full-time jobs. So you really need to understand, the dichotomy of that. So at various points in time, you shift your attention to fundraising and at other times to operating the company. I think what makes us attractive to investors is because the long-term play here is really significantly attractive. So first of all, we aren't just a marketing play. We have IP that's protected by patents now, not just in the US, and any of your listeners who are interested can look us up. It's a number I'll never forget for the rest of my life. Ken, 11411978 is our US patent number. So they can go look it up at Google Patents or USPTO. But the point is, we have a substantial distinction that's protected by demonstrating to third parties who certify and validate that by granting you a patent. And in this particular case, our patent is a business process patent, not some gimmicky little tool for training or gamification or all the stuff that people think are important that really don't change results. Two, we have an experienced team that has done this before. I think it always helps when the management team can interface with investors and demonstrate an understanding of the challenges of a startup. And they're always challenging. They're never easy. They're never easy, and they're no easier for us than anybody else. But I think when you have the right people with some experience, you gain the trust of investors. And then they, in turn, when they see the results, I'll just give you some examples. Although, like all companies, we have some seasonality. We had a couple of really good quarters, a kind of a slow summer. And now we see our pipeline exploding. And you go, what's that about? Well, some of that is the fuel added by the capital. But honestly, Ken, it was a three-letter agency called the SEC. You may have heard of them. And the SEC made law across the country. It announced last spring it was undertaking a review of cybersecurity guidelines for publicly traded companies. It then issued the draft guidelines after consultation with industry on July the 26th, and they came into force on September the 5th. And the final reporting deadline for compliance for publicly traded companies in the US is December the 15th. That is a speed that is breathtaking, and it is sending ripple waves through, and it should for any of your listeners, by the way, have not looked at this, and also all of your SaaS executives. If you've not mapped your particular tool to these new guidelines, you're missing an opportunity to tap into that. You should really spend your time and understand that as the cadence and the step of the regulator changes, Ken, all of our behavior has to change. And what's so vitally important, the subtext of this and why it works so well for Cybercon IQ and probably for many of your listeners out there, is the SEC is really saying, look, we're tired. 10 years we've been hearing you're doing more, investing more. You've got this tool, this gimmick, this gadget, this platform, all of it. You're buying it, you're installing it, you're doing it. And guess what? Breaches and losses have gone up every single quarter, every single year for more than 10 years. So they're communicating to all of us the necessity to move from an activity and input-based model to demonstrating that we understand how we can keep our organization safer. We can prove that. and that we can do one of three things, because you can only do three things with risk, Ken, right? And this is true for your entrepreneurs in the audience as it is for my corporate clients. There's three things you can do. You can try and mitigate the risk. That's investments in tools and processes and all the things we offer and many of your clients offer. You can make investments to mitigate, but you have to prove that they actually work, and you have to prove that they have an impact that can be measured. Two, you can transfer the risk. And many of us have done that in cybersecurity by having insurance, right? I mean, cyber insurance. But it's an unstable market with increasing premiums, and it is really going to start turning a negative corner, because we have seen and experienced three consecutive quarters of growth and successful attacks. And major insurers are really scratching their heads going, why would we stay this exposed to this risk? Because it's not working. And then the third thing is accept it. And the SEC has basically said to boards and executives that if you're going to accept the risk, you need to articulate very specific strategy and governance and controls that is set and establish the amount of risk you're willing to tolerate, why that's the right number, and what you've done to assure yourself that you're meeting it. This is earth-shaking change in our business. So for your listeners, this is timely, it's important. And the classic example of why you can see this would be the recent MGM Caesars attack. As you probably know, it not only made public news, but they voluntarily complied with an 8K filing, which is part of new requirements. And they did so even before the regulations took effect, Ken. And it's because they think they're a sitting duck for being probably an early test case in litigation if they don't do all the right things, because they're being watched. So when you're being watched, you're just much more careful. It's like all human beings, right? So there's some really neat stuff happening out there in cyber. And so I know that was a long answer, but I hope a really useful one for your audience.
Well, definitely. I mean, the environment across the board in GRC, I think, is getting tighter. It doesn't almost matter what domain you operate in. There's going to be a different posture for almost any operational system, and certainly public companies at the front end of that in financial services and insurance especially.
Yeah, although we shouldn't restrict the impact of this just to public companies, right? Although you're right, the SEC only has authority over publicly traded companies. I will tell you the amazing shift to, and an important part of this, is requiring companies to go to their furthest endpoint at the tactical edge of their perimeter and say, if you've got companies that are hooked up to you, you've got APIs, you're working closely, like think of how many SaaS companies are interconnected to their clients. And now imagine the SEC says it's no longer good enough just to put in place a liability clause in a contract that places the responsibility for a vendor-related attack on the vendor. You actually need to, as a public company, have a way to assess, certify, and control the risk of that contagion coming back through that to you. Now, when you shift the landscape to include all of your downline and all of your third parties, you really do change how we think about risk, don't you? And that incorporates, by the way, a ton of private companies that, while technically not subject to the new SEC guidelines, all of your clients, and I'm going to tell every CEO of every SaaS company out there, all of your public company clients are going to come knocking shortly, and you better have some pretty good answers scripted. And if you need some help, call me. We have a professional services. We can help you script these. You had better have a way of tying that to these new guidelines and making sure that you can help your companies establish what the level of risk is that you are also presenting and running. Because if you don't, you are going to find yourself quickly in a place where you're going to get unhooked or dispatched, because the business decision that brought you in was made before these guidelines were issued. These guidelines have changed the world of interconnected risk. So again, I hope for your audience's sake, they're looking at that and getting good advice. By the way, being an attorney, I can say this carefully. All good advice does not flow from attorneys, by the way, especially not attorneys without solid knowledge in this domain. So be careful to get it from somebody who truly is an expert, and to balance multiple perspectives, because there's one view that says you do this and that's to mitigate against litigate, right? That's a classic strategy. But there's much more to it. And I think being thoughtful about how you map your products and offerings to the impact on a public company would be very wise in the coming weeks and months, because you're going to see a flurry of activity.
You know, that's a really interesting thing. I think anybody who's negotiated a master services agreement with a large corporation is starting to see that creep in to the terms and conditions about your responsibility. And I think it goes even beyond cyber risk, you know, this kind of threat. We have a client in the AI governance space, and one of their emerging businesses, business lines, is embedding their AI governance in other software that would be sold to those large corporations. So I think it's a really good point. It's not just a publicly held company enterprise risk, but it's anybody who wants to sell to them,
right,
is going to be scrutinized. And right. Certainly our most recent master services agreement that we saw from a big PE-backed firm was astonishing for the terms and conditions that they were seeking to impose on us. So I think you're absolutely right. If you haven't seen it yet, you're going to see it soon.
Yeah, it's rapidly evolving and it is a new landscape.
So I want to sort of change the channel with you a little bit, if you don't mind, and talk about how you as a leader are really trying to push the organization to be more aggressive. When we talked last, you know, you wanted to push things like a guarantee of a change post-implementation of your program. And, you know, often, or even taking on competitors in your messaging. And often it's the other way around. The marketing or salespeople are the ones that really want to push that envelope. And it's the C-suite that kind of dials it back. So tell me a little bit about why you're so confident that you want to push the envelope and what you're actually considering doing or are now doing in the field.
So let me distinguish two words that I think are really critical to your audience in understanding your question and my response. So you have organizations that are mission-driven and organizations that are marketing-driven. And I think they're not really the same thing. And I want to pause there for a second. That's not at all to say that our friends and colleagues and all the professionals in marketing are sort of not as valuable as people who are kind of mission-driven. But I think there's a big distinction to be made. So as a founder who developed this in a lab and proved it and took a very scientific approach to that, including getting a patent, I would consider myself mission-driven. I am hell-bent to leather, Ken, to use a well-worn phrase, hell-bent to leather to bring this product to market, not just to expand its footprint, but to bring its value to as many users as we can, to right the balance between attackers and defenders. And that is what breaks my heart, that the amount of damage done. I mean, recent statistics, you're asking about the economic harm. Current stats suggest that the U.S. economy is bleeding about $1.5 billion a month in successful cyber attacks currently, the current run rate. That's an astounding amount of wealth. Look in your own personal circles. I'd ask any listener, how many of us don't know somebody who has faced identity theft or credential compromise or something where there has been a meaningful personal impact? These are creepy, disgusting people preying on us, and it's not sustainable. So we have to right the balance between attackers and defenders. So I get very passionate, as you might be able to tell. I get very passionate about that mission. So then we come to marketers, and of course, marketers are professionals like all of us, and sales professionals and marketing professionals, you're right, are normally quite aggressive. But I'm not sure that they know quite how to take that fervor and that passion for the mission and translate it to marketing. And I don't like the term aggressive. I like the term persuasive. I want to be out there with a message that has people not believing that this is marketing hype, but this is real results. This is proven stuff that can really matter and can help right that balance. And the problem, of course, is for 10 years, they've been seeing company after company after company promise that whatever they're offering is the greatest thing since sliced bread. It's going to make a difference. It's going to help. And I got bad news for everybody. We haven't done our jobs because it's not making as much of a difference as it needs to. And that's why we're in this mess with the SEC. And by the way, forthcoming with NIST, same thing, changing us away from, don't tell me what you've done. Tell me what you've done that works. So it's kind of, we're in a saturated marketing environment. And this is my fifth startup. This is the hardest startup I've had, Ken, to actually take something that I'm very passionate about, that I know works, and that if anybody listens to me, I can prove within a matter of a few minutes, I think you've discovered that today, that this is substantially different. It's differentiated and it makes a difference. But to break through and get that at bat, to have that discussion, the marketing noise that is out there that has been exacerbated in the age of the internet and global connected commerce means that getting your message to break through is really hard. So I don't know whether the word is aggressive or persuasive, and I don't know whether it's the difference in mission and marketing, but that's how I think about it. I want everybody in my team to share that determination for this mission and to bring this message out, and not as a marketing message, but as an impactful discussion about the differences between trying something and proving that what you're trying is working. And those are not the same thing.
I love the rallying cry of, you know, changing the balance of power between attackers and defenders. Oh. That's a really kind of a soulful phrase.
Yeah. And I'm sick of them winning. Like, it just makes me heartsick. The number of calls I get in any week, Ken, from people who have just recently been attacked, and now they're asking us what we can do to help them. And I want to sort of just hang my head in shame or something and cry and go, why didn't you find us before you got attacked?
There's a great fear, uncertainty, and doubt message for you. Hey, let's change the channel one more time. I want to get into.
I feel like we're riding a bike up and down hills, but go ahead.
We are. We've got a lot to cover, and this is probably a topic we could do an hour on, but we only have half an hour. So let's talk about why your training is different. You know, what is the fundamental essence of how you are helping organizations better defend themselves? I think that it's worth exploring because, as you said, not every solution is a technology solution. This is a people solution at the end. Sure, you're delivering it at scale, but let's talk about what's actually different here.
So I'm going to return to your earlier comment about health for just a second. So let's go back to this idea that humans are unique, not just because of our reasoning and our intellect. I mean, every single one of us has a supercomputer that operates at room temperature right above our shoulders. And I'll tell you, for all the work being done on quantum computing and the amount of chilling power necessary to enable quantum computing, Ken, the human brain is a spectacularly wonderful and amazing jungle. Now, that jungle is one that is complex to understand. And so psychology has set out for a long time to understand, and we can only understand this from the outside in. We can't really get into brains except when people are dead, and we can dissect them and look at their constructs, their architecture, and their contents. But the idea of a sentient human being and reasoning, we can only delve into this from the outside. So let's use the example of health for just a second. We all have different priorities, different impulses and instincts. Some of us are prone, for instance, to overeating. Some of us to undereating. You can find food disorders on both sides of that. You can find people who are able to control their appetites and their weight and for whom that's important, and others who can't. You find some who say, well, I want to keep eating because I get joy out of eating, but I'm willing to work my tail off in the gym so I can eat more and eat what I want and so on. So you look at this range of human reasoning and emotion, and that's personality. And every single one of us is different in our approach to that particular problem. So when you have all of these different things going on, you can't assume that a single message or a single way of doing anything is going to reach most human beings. You have to be able to figure out how at scale we can unpack that personality, discover what the triggers and the motivations and the inclinations and impulses are, and then we have to fix them literally one person at a time. Now, doing that at scale is really complicated. So we use a very simple diagnostic. Think of it like Myers-Briggs for cybersecurity. Have you ever done Myers-Briggs or PII or Colors or StrengthFinders? Every single listener on this call is going to go right away, oh yeah, I've done one of those. All right, well, if you've done one of those, you know it has nothing to do with cybersecurity knowledge. It has everything to do with your instincts and impulses. In our particular case, it's the degree to which somebody is either risk-averse or risk-seeking and whether or not they're rule-abiding or rule-breaking. Now, for the cyber professionals in the audience or for compliance and GRC folks, those two dimensions of behavior give you all the insight you need into why people will or will not comply. And then you can set out on a journey to figure out what to do about that. So once we got the basic understanding that no generic way will ever give you a sustainable personal result, and we had to go down the personalization path, that began this journey. So the underlying psychology is trait-based personality theory. That's been with us since the 1940s when Gordon Allport, a famous American psychologist at Harvard, invented it. And it's been a very durable part And it's now what we call the psychology big five. So it's a durable part of the science, behavioral science. And when you understand that and you map that to compliance behaviors online, you get some incredible results. And that's what the entire psychological basis for our product is.
So is the next step then is that the training and recommendations that you provide to the individual are based on that assessment?
Yes, in the first instance. And then doing some really cognitively complex work with them to figure out whether they can apply it. So content aggregation, learning that just involves memorizing stuff, is of limited value in today's world because we all have, you know, we have GAI and we have search and we have this. I mean, who memorizes anything today? You don't. So it's not whether or not you've got content in your brain. It's whether or not we've changed the context for how your brain functions when certain kinds of stimuli that you might be susceptible to are put in front of you. So it's actually how we change the balance between susceptibility and motivation to change behavior. And that is done one person and one style at a time. And then after that, there are still some folks who struggle. And the folks who struggle aren't struggling because they don't know, because Ken, we've just proven they know, right? Because they passed all this assessment. What they didn't do is they didn't apply the knowledge in the moment. That's a different psychological problem. That's known as situational distractibility. And it has to do with what we call pattern interrupt. It has to do with the fact you have to get out of that flow. So I'm just going to ask people, you know, our listeners on this podcast or you, if you were to look at what's open on your desktop while we're recording this, you lead a busy, multitasked online world, right? And it's complicated. So when you think about operating that world, you need to get people to do the thing that's hardest for us in the very first step of our model. We have a mnemonic for it called SAVE. And we talk to the employees about saving themselves from themselves, which is an interesting way of thinking about the problem. And the hardest step is the first one, which is to get them to stop. To get that pattern interrupt to occur, to get them to stop in the moment and apply human judgment and intuition, even as they're busy and distracted and all this stuff is on their mind. If they can't consistently do that, then our method will fail. So we pay a lot of attention to this basic behavioral science, and how we actually get the result is far more sophisticated than simply teaching people content. It's teaching them context and then figuring out how to make sure they can consistently apply it.
I think that we've done a good job to this point in the amount of time we have, but I want to turn my attention to a web property you've built called TechElect, where you're trying to give people more confidence in AI applications, and where you also are offering some free training. Can you give us, you know, a minute or so on this community and content destination that you've created and why you've done so?
100%, I can do it under a minute, no problem, Ken. I am going to tell you that because we're mission-driven, we developed this content initially to put in our system for our paid clients. I mean, it made sense because GAI was an emerging threat, as you all will recall, when we started to see the announcements late last year and into the early part of winter and spring. It was becoming clearly available public tool, and it has both incredible potential and incredible peril for humanity. Now, I do not believe GAI is going to end humanity. I believe humanity will end humanity. But nonetheless, I think what
we don't need any help.
We don't need any help. Yeah. But what we do need is to not be afraid of this and to assume that government will regulate or big tech will take care of this. No, we need to equip human beings to understand that you cannot put this genie back in the bottle. We are now in the age of generative AI. And what does that mean? So we took three simple lessons and a bunch of reliable resources, and we had them, and we had such an amazing positive reaction from our clientele, we decided to do something we'd never done in our history, which is to release them for publicly available access for free. So you can find our social mission at techelect.com. There is nothing, you're not going to be marketed or solicited. What you need to do is simply register, and you and your family can get access to those training videos and those lessons and exercises and resources. And it's imperfect because the science of AI is rapidly evolving, but I would far rather that the listeners on this call understand from a reliable and restrained voice that this is not what it's being purported to be in the media. You can do this. You should do this. You need to be aware. Your kids, your parents, your aunts, your uncles, your nieces, your cousins, I don't care who, your pastor, your rabbi, I don't care. Everybody needs to be aware of the potential and the peril. If in fact AI is going to be the positive force for good that it can be. So the thesis of Tech Elect is that human intellect still reigns superior. It must remain in control. And I'm really hoping if your listeners go, they will enjoy the message and the free resources that we're making available for nothing other than the fact that we believe it's incumbent upon us to help solve this problem.
And could you just give us the URL for those resources, please?
www.techelect.com, which is the combination of tech and intellect, dropping the IN. So it's Tech Elect. So it's technology, intellect. It's the merging of AI and human intelligence. And yeah, go and visit the site. And there's more of those resources to come. This is part of our really our social mission and our do good part of what we get to do. And when we have something so compelling and a problem that is so contemporary, it just seemed like the right thing for us to do.
Awesome. So last question, looking back over the last few years, any decisions you as a serial entrepreneur would love to have another swing at, something you'd do differently?
Well, we can never undo this, but this was not only the hardest startup, but I'll tell you, it sure didn't help to have 2 years of COVID dropped into this. So if I'd had a crystal ball, I might have advanced my agenda by 2 years, or I might have put it off till after COVID. It was such a challenge to have to deal with that, because that was another very rapid social shift that was phenomenally disruptive. So, you know what, I don't know that I would have done anything different, but it sure made the journey far more difficult than I'm used to. And it, like everybody else, entrepreneurs had to adapt, and it was challenging for us all. So I'm not saying something that your audience doesn't understand, but it was punishing, especially for young companies like ours. And so I am grateful for the support of our clients. I'm grateful for the support of government. I think we all did what we needed to do, but we are still suffering in business a bit of a COVID hangover. So we're coming out of it still, and companies are very cautious. We're all a bit skittish and anxious. And this business environment, for all of you entrepreneurs, fellow entrepreneurs, we are all doing work in an extraordinarily difficult time. So I'm giving us all a collective pat on the back for the efforts we had collectively to get through COVID, but also what we're doing now dealing with the economic and social uncertainty of what's going on, no matter where we look.
Well, thanks so much. James, if people want to connect with you or learn more about your company, how can they do that?
So they can reach me very easily, jnori@cyberconiq.com, if they want to reach me personally, or they can visit the website, put in an inquiry, or learn more. We put a lot of stuff on our website without requiring you to do very much. You can go to Tech Elect to get the free resources we talked about. However people want to reach us, you can reach us. We're happy to have a conversation. We have both the product platform and professional advisory services to assist. So if something you heard today has got you intrigued, give me a call. I'd be happy to chat.
Excellent. Thanks so much. And if a listener wants to reach me, I'm on LinkedIn/in/KenLempit. My agency's website is austinlawrence.com. And if you haven't subscribed to the podcast yet, please do so wherever podcasts are distributed. Dr. James Nori, thank you so much for being a guest on SaaS Backwards today.
Thank you, Ken. This was a ton of fun.